the Young Members Corner, a podcast series brought to you by the Young Member Service of the American Head and Neck Society, where each episode we bring you topics of interest to the head and neck surgery community with a focus on cutting-edge research in head and neck oncology, controversies in head and neck surgery, and early career development. I'm your host, Andres Burr, and I'm a head and neck and microvascular surgeon at the University of Kansas.
And I'm your co-host, Larissa Sweeney. I did my residency at the University of Alabama in Birmingham and my fellowship at Thomas Jefferson University. I'm currently on faculty at LSU New Orleans.
And I'm Arvind Bave. I did my residency training at Mount Sinai in New York, and I'm currently the head and neck microvascular fellow at the University of Cincinnati.
Welcome to our second episode. Today we will be discussing sentinel lymph node biopsy for early oral cavity squamous cell carcinoma. The question of how to best manage the cervical lymph nodes in patients with early oral cancers is age old. For years, head and neck surgeons have debated whether it was better to remove the lymph nodes up front, even in the absence of regional metastatic disease, or to observe the neck and remove the cervical lymph nodes only for patients who developed lymph node metastasis. That was until 2015, when a landmark prospective trial by Anil de Cruz showed a clear survival benefit of elective neck dissection over watchful waiting with therapeutic neck dissection for nodal relapse. Yet we know that if every patient with early oral cancer has an elective neck dissection, then 70 to 80% of patients will have no nodal disease on pathology. So researchers have tried to find a better way to select patients who should undergo elective neck dissection and those who may be safe to observe. The association between depth of invasion of the primary tumor and risk of occult lymph node metastasis is well established and advocated by some. Other approaches have included developing predictive models, including sophisticated machine learning techniques that use clinical and pathologic data to decide which patients should undergo elective neck dissection. Another approach is sentinel lymph node biopsy, which has become the standard of care for cutaneous melanoma and Merkel cell carcinoma and has gained traction for early oral cancers in Europe. Our guest, Dr. Stephen Lai, is a professor of head and neck surgery at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. Dr. Lai was principal investigator of a multi-center, single-arm trial to evaluate the reliability of sentinel lymph node biopsy in head and neck squamous cell carcinoma. The results of the trial, which were published in Annals of Surgical Oncology in 2015, showed sentinel lymph node biopsy to be highly reliable, with a high negative predictive value and a low false negative rate. In other words, patients with a negative sentinel lymph node biopsy can now feel confident that their remaining cervical lymph nodes are uninvolved by tumor. Dr. Lai is now the principal investigator of NRG Oncology HN006, a phase 2/3 trial to compare sentinel lymph node biopsy to elective neck dissection for early oral cancers. This multi-center randomized trial is currently active, so we sat down with Dr. Lai to talk about sentinel lymph node biopsy for early oral cancer, how he got involved in clinical trial development, and what advice he has for young head and neck surgeons. Welcome, Dr. Lai.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to your group today.
So to get started, I wanted to see what your thoughts are on sentinel lymph node biopsy for early oral cancer and why it's a good idea.
Okay. Well, so despite progress clinically and diagnostically to evaluate the neck for early stage oral cavity cancer and specifically T1, T2 disease, we know that about 20 to 30% of patients who are considered node negative after evaluation during surgery or subsequently will be found to be pathologically N positive. And the current practice really is to manage the neck with an elective neck dissection. That has been sort of an evolution that has taken several decades to kind of come to that conclusion that you need to actively manage the neck, and really reached sort of the pinnacle or the highest sort of definitive evidence through the de Cruz study that was published in 2015 after decades of debate between watchful waiting versus elective neck dissection. So, once that issue was kind of resolved, we know that sentinel lymph node biopsy has been very effective in, say, melanoma, the management of melanoma, and certainly in the head and neck, and things like breast cancer. And so the idea of actually being able to target those lymph nodes that are highest at risk is attractive versus, say, doing a comprehensive or elective neck dissection, where you do spare the critical structures of the neck, but you are removing all of the sort of lymph nodes in that area. The surgery itself has potential for morbidity, even in the hands of sort of seasoned practitioners and seasoned head and neck surgeons. And the idea that we could then, using a radio tracer, sort of identify those nodes that are highest at risk for harboring metastatic disease gives you potentially an option to really create more personalized surgery for the patient, but also gives the option that with a smaller surgery that maybe you have less likelihood of having morbidity after the neck procedure. And so those are the reasons that sentinel lymph node biopsy has kind of evolved as far as a sort of change in the standard of care.
Yeah, that's great. And for those listeners who aren't aware, you were the PI of the tilmanocept trial, and that was a phase 3 multi-institutional trial to evaluate the false negative rate of sentinel lymph node biopsy for patients with early oral cancers. And you found a very high negative predictive value, 97.8%, which is reassuring for patients who have a negative sentinel lymph node biopsy that they don't, in fact, have regional metastatic disease. So how did that develop into HN006? What was the rationale for HN006, which is really the follow-up to the tilmanocept trial?
So, you know, tilmanocept or LymphoSeq, which is now distributed by Cardinal Health, was developed by a company as sort of first in class, and it was receptor targeted. So it actually binds to the CD206 receptor, which is found on reticuloendothelial cells like macrophages or dendritic cells that are inside lymph nodes. And so unlike, say, sulfur colloid or nanocol, which is very popular and widely used in Europe, instead of injecting around the tumor and then having sort of passive diffusion through the lymphatic channels to the lymph nodes and then potentially through the lymph nodes to secondary lymph nodes, The radio tracer at LymphoSeq, because it can bind CD206, is thought to be more avidly sort of accumulated inside the first echelon lymph nodes. And so thus you get a better sense of what's the highest, those lymph nodes that are highest at risk for harboring disease from a given tumor. It's really NEO306, which was then the FDA registration study for tilmanocept, as well as the ACOSOG Z0360 study, which Frank Savantos led and that was published in JCO in 2010. But it was really the basis of those two studies. If you look even at the ACOSOG trial, there was a fairly high negative predictive value there also. And subsequent meta-analyses have demonstrated that we know that there can be that the negative predictive value for sentinel lymph node for early stage oral cavity cancer is quite high. The real question has been, you know, is it worth adopting, not just from a negative predictive value, but also then from a sense of what the false negative rate actually is for sentinel lymph node biopsy, and then how best to compare that to elective neck dissection. But ultimately, when you're sort of talking about sort of equivalence or non-inferiority of the two procedures, you want to understand what disease-free survival is. I mean, ultimately, you have to understand that the doing a procedure does not affect sort of the survival of your patients, and especially in this sort of early stage oral cavity cancer category. And so that was really the impetus for sort of starting this. If you actually look at the NCCN guidelines, in fact, sentinel lymph node biopsy has been adopted in that algorithm as part of standard of care. It is considered a viable option as compared to elective neck dissection for management of early stage oral cavity cancer that's N0, where you need to assess the neck. So, you know, when we started thinking about this, the impetus for the study, though, was to actually really develop level one evidence in this regard. You know, the Europeans have been doing sentinel lymph node biopsy for quite some time. There are a lot of retrospective studies. There's a lot of sort of single institution experience. And frankly, there are even large studies like the SENT trial out of the UK, where they did only sentinel lymph node biopsy and then followed those patients out and sort of saw how they did. but there hasn't really been a head-to-head comparison of sentinel lymph node biopsy and elective neck dissection for these patients. And so that's really the rationale for sort of doing this. I sort of watched, as when the DeCruz paper was published in 2015, and you sort of realize that there was four decades of kind of debate behind that. So it took 40 years of kind of wondering about watchful waiting and elective neck dissection. There are certainly a lot of panels and a lot of meta-analyses and a lot of expert reviews in the area, but there wasn't a lot of level one evidence. And while we know that the DeCruz study isn't perfect, it has actually given us the highest level evidence with regard to that particular question. And so I sort of thought, you know, this is a question that we should decide and that we should use the best sort of evidence possible and use the best tools we have in sort of a prospective randomized clinical trial to try to look at this issue of sentinel lymph node biopsy versus elective neck dissection. And so that's kind of what sort of compelled me to kind of move forward through the NIH, sort of the NCI NCTN process to sort of bring up the concept for this kind of trial. And it was really in the development of that it became sort of a phase two, phase three design.
Just as a follow-up to that, how did you get involved in leading clinical trials of sentinel lymph node biopsy?
I think that the NEO 306 trial was sort of very informative. We certainly have done small trials at different institutions. I've been part of phase one studies for quite some time. Those are usually smaller sort of 15, 20 patient sort of studies. It's not so much for efficacy, but it's about safety and toxicity. I've done some other trials like the NEO 306 trial, and that was sort of multi-institutional, but it was sort of industry sponsored. It has a specific goal of sort of FDA registration of a new product. When I sort of started thinking about this issue with sentinel lymph node biopsy, I was fortunate because Eric Sturgis, who the colleague of mine, was also leading the surgical subcommittee for NRG oncology, and he was also a member of one of the task forces. And so when I started talking to him about this idea, he was able to invite me to come to the meetings and sort of present the concept. That's a valuable educational experience because you're going up in front of surgeons and medical oncologists and radiation oncologists and, you know, experts in sort of quality of life issues and a lot of other domains, all that are very germane to the design of a clinical trial that's sort of as expansive as this one is. But that's sort of how you start to kind of hone the ideas and sort of add the contributions that sort of make the study effective, but also make it translatable because it sort of broadly covers issues that are of interest to a lot of different parties.
I'd like to just ask a question about NRG. So I personally haven't attended any meetings. I know some of my mentors have gone, and I guess if you could speak a little bit more to what advantages there are to attending the meetings, what, say, a young someone just starting out in their career could gain from going there, in addition to what you've just highlighted, maybe if you could expound on that a little bit more.
First, I will say that the groups that include NRG Oncology, ECOG Akron, SWOG, and Alliance, all of them are cooperative trial groups, different linkages to various institutions. So you can find out which one your institution may have, you know, closer ties to and participate in their studies more often. The nice thing, though, is if your institution is related to any of those, once a trial opens in the NCTN network, so for example, HN006 is an NRG oncology study, but if your institution is related to ECOG or to SWOG, you still have the opportunity to open those studies across, you know, the trial, even though it's in sort of a different cooperative group. I will also say that there is a lot of push amongst those organizations to try to encourage young members to join and to participate. And so I know specifically for NRG Oncology, there are sort of young member drives and application processes to help. And hopefully once we're outside of the pandemic, to help with travel funds and things like that so that young people can come and see what's going on. I think the real value of going to a place like that is that you get to see some of the thought leaders and some of the clinical trial leaders and sort of understand what are the sort of interesting sort of questions that are sort of very clinically relevant that are being sort of addressed at sort of that broad level. I mean, we're talking about studies that that have garnered a lot of interest across a lot of institutions. I think, you know, this one certainly is about early stage oral cavity cancer and looking at two surgical procedures, sort of sentinel lymph node biopsy versus elective neck dissection. And it is rare and unusual that there is really a surgical trial going on. It's one of those things that I like to say, I want to encourage surgeons to participate now, because I absolutely believe there should be more surgical trials in the future, and that you gain experience in sort of managing a clinical trial by actually participating in one. And then that sort of gives you the chops that you need to be able to actually propose one and then lead it through the process. And so I've tried very hard to make sure that even the young surgeons will be able to sort of get into NRG HN006. But, you know, there have been studies like the TORS sort of study through ECOG and things like that. But the other issues that sort of are relevant today is, you know, immunotherapy. We're looking at sort of that issue. There have been trials. I think the RTOG 1016 trial sort of really showed us, you know, cisplatin versus cetuximab. It probably wasn't the finding that we were hoping to see. But I think that tells you why it's so important to do these studies, you know, because you need those fundamental answers. And in fact, one of the studies that's coming through NRG now is going to be about this issue of concurrent chemotherapy and radiation therapy and cisplatin. And should we be giving cisplatin on a weekly basis or a Q3 weekly basis? And you'd think, you know, maybe we should know that already. And yet we don't have, again, that sort of highest level sort of data to really give us that in. And yet this is exactly the kind of form where we can recruit enough patients and recruit them across a lot of different institutions and sort of really understand, you know, which one is better in terms of effectiveness for disease control, but also in terms of what kind of toxicity profiles are present in our patients. And so I think the experience is not necessarily that, hey, I'm going to go run a clinical trial and that's what I want to do, but the experience of going allows you to understand, you know, what are the big questions out there and what are the thought leaders and people who you see publishing in the really high impact journals and then maybe leading the sort of spores and the research sort of programs at high powered institutions, but you get to actually see what are the discussions there. And quite frankly, they're all welcoming to young surgeons and young clinicians because they want to sort of engage you in sort of this process.
I was gonna make a comment actually, Dr. Lai, before you go into that. I just kind of commenting on some of the things you said as obviously a fellow who hasn't really been involved in too many of these things. I thought you made a really good point in that when you're a resident or a trainee, you kind of assume all these things as fact, and you just kind of learn certain things, like you're talking about the frequency of giving cisplatin, for example. And I think it's interesting to understand as you start to appreciate this process that there are a lot of fundamental questions that we don't really have great evidence for, and we just kind of assume is kind of the dogma. So I think that's actually just something I wanted to highlight, because I think that as a early trainee and even as a fellow, you start to appreciate that all the things that were regularly being done don't necessarily have kind of those surgical trials or those that prospective data. So I just kind of wanted to highlight that before you move on. Sorry.
Great.
Yeah, when I started here, nobody was doing sentinel lymph node biopsies for oral cavity, and I did a lot of them in fellowship. And so I actually had a patient that was perfect for it. And when I presented it, my senior partner's like, well, you're going to have to come to tumor board with all the data to support this, because otherwise nobody's going to back you up on it. And they're not going to think that this is okay. And so it just kind of like took me back, because they were doing it all the time in my fellowship. And so to have to come and justify and like you said, learn all the reasons why it is okay to be doing this was interesting.
Right. I mean, I think we learn so much of so much of what we do in sort of cancer care and sometimes in surgical care is driven by history and tradition. And so it's as we sort of step into a future that's driven more by science and sort of high level, sort of quality, high quality evidence, I think it's absolutely critical for us as surgeons to be part of that and to understand that, you know, when we're going to try to change the standard of care, what are the requirements there? And so I think your sort of more senior surgeons were right. Hey, bring the evidence, bring the data. But the question really is, what is that data? You know, what is the kind of data that we can bring? And I think surgeons have been used to sort of providing, hey, this is my experience. And that sort of qualifies then as retrospective data. And unfortunately, we all kind of know that that's not the highest level of data that we have. And I think if we're going to continue to have that conversation with our other colleagues, like our medical oncologists and our radiation oncologists, that we have to be at the table and we have to participate in sort of prospective, randomized clinical trials that hopefully are multi-institutional, so that we can get broader buy-in as we try to change and improve how we take care of our patients.
I want to hear a little bit more about the process. Just, you know, from that initial meeting that you described, presenting the idea for HN006 to the actual approval, and you know, by the, you know, the time when you realize this is going to be a trial, what was that time interval like?
It took about I want to say about 18 months to 20 really get to sort of a point where they said, okay, you got a good concept. And then once the concept was sort of vetted by all of my co-chairs, then it went to through a voting process, because you take it through the specific subsite, so head and neck cancer. But then NRG also has a lot of other groups, you know, like lung and GYN and et cetera. And so your study then has to be prioritized relative to all those other studies too. And so once they felt like this was a sort of well-evolved concept, then it went up for sort of priority scoring. And then once it got sort of a high enough priority score, then it went to the Head and Neck Steering Committee. Now, Head and Neck Steering Committee is part of NCI, but is part of something called CTEP, or the Clinical Therapeutics Evaluation Program. CTEP oversees and sort of runs, is sort of parallel to the cooperative trials groups. But ultimately, CTEP gives you or doesn't give you approval to sort of move forward for protocol development. And so I then presented the trial to our Head and Neck Steering Committee. The steering committee had also members from the NCI CTEP on it, and then they voted to see whether or not it would move forward to protocol development. You have two shots at the Head and Neck Steering Committee. And so the first time you go, they can say yes, no, or sort of pending. And pending means that they have questions or issues that they'd like you to address. And then if you're able to address them, then you can potentially go forward to protocol development. So for us with HN006, there were kind of two issues. One was they wanted to make sure, and I think this is where we as surgeons still need to kind of demonstrate our interest and enthusiasm. They wanted to make sure that if they invested in a surgical trial, because this was really going to be kind of a surgical trial at its base, that there would actually be enough surgeon interest in sort of participating. And we had sort of anticipated that as sort of being a question. And so we had sent out surveys and sort of, you know, polled surgeons to make sure there would be interest. But then to sort of further answer that question for them, I then went out and got letters of support. So, you know, I think 35 or 40 institutions that, you know, said, hey, we would be in, this is potential number of patients we could provide on a yearly basis to this study. And so that, I think, really helped kind of answer that question for them. The second issue that we also then sort of faced was, well, if sentinel lymph node biopsy has been already kind of adopted in Europe, why is it adopted here in the US? And, you know, because it's part of the NCCN guidelines, you know, if there are sort of barriers to activation to sort of changing your standard of care, would what would you need to show surgeons to sort of convince them that they should actually change to sentinel lymph node biopsy? And I think what this head and neck steering committee really looked at was, what's the quality of the data that's available with regard to sort of morbidity in comparing sentinel lymph node biopsy with elective neck dissection? And I think what they sort of saw was, hey, there's some evidence that suggests it could be better, you know, as far as for quality of life. But a lot of that data, again, is retrospective or single institution, and it isn't very robust. Well, so that's where I was able to then sort of go back, and we talk to our to the experts in the area of quality of life and patient reported outcomes. And that's where we said, okay, so let's develop a phase two portion of this study. And we are actually going to have the phase two portion of this study be driven by the patient reported outcomes and quality of life. Because if we can now get at the highest sort of level one evidence, you know, data that suggests that there is really a difference in quality of life, then that might be sufficient to then say to convince surgeons to kind of change the way they practice. But if you don't have that evidence, even after sort of gaining it or gathering it at it in sort of this multi-institutional randomized way, then maybe it's not worth kind of pushing forward to the phase three portion of the study. So HN006 actually has a phase two portion that's driven by the neck dissection impairment inventory, the NDII. And we're looking for a clinically meaningful difference between neck dissection and sentinel lymph node biopsy in the initial about 228 patients or so. And there is actually a go, no-go rule that we'll sort of look at when we reach that sort of accrual target. And we'll make a decision based on that, whether or not to then move forward to the second part of the study. And the second part of the study, of course, is the larger sort of accrual. It'll include the patients we've already gotten into the phase two portion, but that's the part that then will look at disease-free survival. And it will also look at sort of quality of life, but as a co-primary endpoint. I think what we see now with some of the evidence that's available in sentinel lymph node biopsy is that there have been some sort of compromises made with regard to kind of non-inferiority, what they'll accept as sort of being a reasonable non-inferiority difference. And when you start to extend that number to 10% or 12% with regard to survival, yes, it creates statistical analysis that allows you to have a fairly reasonable sort of patient cohort size that you need to do your study. But I think as surgeons, when we start to evaluate that data, we're saying, oh, you know, are we really willing to accept 10% less or 12% less potentially disease-free survival for our patients? And I think a lot of us have basically sort of voted with our feet or with our hands saying, no, at this point, that kind of evidence isn't the sort of best available evidence. But that's, again, part of the reason and part of the process that you go through the vetting. To get back to your original question, but you go through this vetting process, and yeah, so it took about 4 years to get to the point where we could open it up. Now, you know, I certainly had some trepidation opening this trial in the middle of a pandemic, right? And so, you know, we opened officially July of 2020. So, you know, it was sort of great to kind of hit that milestone, but we were kind of just coming off yet another surge in the United States. And so we've still been trying to kind of recover from that sort of that kind of opening for the study.
So Larissa, I'd be interested in your thoughts on the kind of lukewarm, I would say, reception that you had to starting to do sentinel lymph node biopsy for early oral cancers, and kind of how you bring something new like that to an institution.
Yeah, so that was a few years ago. So most of the data that was available at that point were those European trials that you referenced. That did have some, you know, pretty good 2 and 5 year survival, at least that implied that they were similar. And so I pulled all those articles, and we did a journal club on sentinel lymph node for oral cavity. So I'm sure the residents love that. But we kind of reviewed them, and the senior radiation oncologist and surgeon have, he's not going to do them, but he's more comfortable with me doing them. And if he has a patient he thinks is a candidate, he will have me see them. But the other hurdle was from a pathology standpoint. I think the recommendation is that you do maybe at least 10 a year, or in that the first 20 that you do in a, you take the sentinel lymph nodes out and then do the elective neck to make sure that the pathologist is actually, you know, bread loafing them properly and staining them properly and not missing any squames in their analysis of the sentinel node.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And Dr. Lai, what are your other thoughts as far as why more head and neck surgeons in the U.S. aren't doing this routinely?
So I do think that anytime we engage in sort of a change in sort of approach, that it always takes a little bit of time for that to actually happen. I do think that the evidence for sentinel lymph node biopsy is still in evolution. But I that was sort of the reason I wanted to try to create a situation where we'd be doing a study that hopefully was definitive in that regard. With what Larissa sort of referenced, you know, one of the things in the study is that we have central reads for all of the sentinel lymph node biopsies. And I think that's important, not only for the sort of data integrity in the study itself, but I also think that there's, you know, if depending on the volume at a particular institution, I think there is value in just having that work backstopped. Because it is so absolutely critical for sentinel lymph node biopsy. So I think there's learning at an institutional level as well as learning at a surgical level that potentially can occur for that. Your question about why, you know, that's a good question. You know, I think people have talked about this issue of, you know, is it I actually think one of the biggest issues is that where we were able to, or where we would just do a neck dissection, and I think 70 to 80% of them would be pathologically negative, we're now saying, okay, we're going to do just the sentinel lymph node biopsy, but you may have to take about 20 to 30% of patients back for a completion neck dissection. And I think that change in the workflow is potentially one of the sort of things that is challenging for surgeons to kind of change, and especially in sort of institutions that may have high volume and sort of difficulty with sort of OR schedule block time and things like that. But I do think that as we sort of explore radio tracers that may be a little more accurate, as we get better pathology, I think there are sort of opportunities to sort of, you know, honestly, to do a better job assessing who is really N0. You're never going to be 100% perfect without sort of pathologic confirmation. But I think we can reduce that number and sort of make this an even more attractive modality. And I think really as is borne out with a lot of surgical procedures, but a lot of procedures that sort of, this one is multi-step, right? It's got an imaging component, it's got a surgical component, it's got a pathology component. But the more you do these kinds of procedures, the better kind of your accuracy and your precision becomes.
Stay tuned for a conversation with Dr. Lai on the challenges of quality assurance in prospective surgical trials.
So one of the things that's always an issue is quality assurance. You know, how do you know that the pathology is good? How do you know that the imaging is good? And frankly, how do you know that the surgery is good? Right. And so for HN006, we have a working group that's really about surgical quality assurance. And when we credential the surgeons, we're actually checking to see what experience they've had with sentinel lymph node biopsy, but we're also looking at what their experience is with even elective neck dissection. Okay. And so that's a reflection not only of how well the surgeon does as far as harvesting lymph nodes, but also a measure of how good the pathologist is at actually. So what is your nodal count coming out of those? Okay. And so that's part of the case review and the credentialing process for the surgeons. We also continue to actually, every case is then vetted afterwards to look at sort of outcomes and pathology status and things like that. With regard to the pathology, as I already mentioned to you, the sentinel lymph node cases, you know, it's not so much, you know, if a sentinel lymph node's positive, it's very rare that you're going to get a false positive. You know, the things that we're really concerned about are the false negatives. And so we're doing central review for the sentinel lymph nodes too. And then the other part of it is that, you know, we ended up incorporating the findings from Akron's 6685, you know. So there's a PET CT study that suggests that, you know, a very high negative predictive value for PET CT for T2 to T4 disease, okay, as far as looking at the nodal status in the neck. And so when you know, one of the things about cooperative groups is they like to try to take the current studies and what findings are, what you get from those studies, and how do you incorporate them into studies. And so they asked us to sort of incorporate PET CT in. Now, there was a lot of sort of resistance because people were saying, well, early stage cancer, especially T1, would you even get a PET CT normally? You know, if you're really looking for neck disease and you're looking potentially more for micrometastases. Well, so we said we can incorporate it, but we're not sure the insurance companies are going to pay for it. But if it's really an important question to the NCTN or to CTEP, then pay for it. And so in the end, they said, you know what, we would rather pay for the study now and get enough patients to actually answer this with level one evidence than to have, say, potentially a lot of people getting PET CT scans in the future. So that's kind of how we're trying to ensure all of that. I know you were asking, you know, I sort of see HNO06 as not only answering these questions, but in a way sort of trying to standardize the processes that are available, that are required to do a sentinel lymph node program. And so, you know, the other sort of piece of this was we had an international symposium in 2018 that was looking at sentinel lymph node biopsy for the head and neck. And so we ended up publishing three guideline papers, or actually we published two guideline papers thus far. One was a nuclear medicine paper that looks at sort of sentinel node mapping and what are the best practices for that mapping. The second one is we published a paper in Head and Neck that looks at sort of that's sort of a consensus guidelines for how to do sentinel lymph node biopsy for oral cavity cancer. And then I know that the third paper is still in progress as far as finding a sort of landing place as far as peer review, but that will be a pathology paper. So I think those are kind of a good starting place. You know, you try to have best practices or consensus guidelines to start. But then we tried to incorporate as many of those best practices as possible into the protocol. And so, you know, some people will say, well, if you're going to do something like this, you should really do it in a trial setting. And so we tried to create enough incentive in this study so that by doing the study, you would also be beginning to understand what are kind of best practices for doing sentinel lymph node biopsy in the head and neck.
One thing I just wanted to comment on was, for me, I found a pathologist that was willing and interested in doing the sentinel lymph node biopsies. And so she's sort of the pathologist I use for all of those cases. And she pulled a few pathology papers that kind of had recommendations on technique and staining. But once yours is out, I'll reference that one as well.
Okay, that's good.
One of the things that I think, you know, you alluded to that's really challenging about surgical trials. I mean, with the medical oncology trial, you know, you're comparing different types of chemotherapy. I mean, you know that the patient is getting the chemotherapy that they're assigned. You don't have to worry about the purity of the chemotherapy, if you will. With the surgical trial, how do you deal with the variation in case volume, level of experience between your surgeons, and how does that, you know, how is that factored into credentialing, safety monitoring, et cetera?
So I think we recognized from the ACOSOG Z0360 trial, you know, when there was a feasibility study to look at, you know, can we do sentinel lymph node biopsy for oral cavity cancers? I think they recognized that the negative predictive value, there was a difference between sort of experienced surgeons and sort of non-experienced surgeons. And so we tried to incorporate that understanding into how we sort of brought surgeons on board for HN006. So like the TOR study where there was a credentialing sort of process, we do a credentialing process here where we require that, you know, and it's not that necessarily that everyone has done an oral cavity sentinel lymph node biopsy, but we'd like to know that you've had some experience doing sentinel lymph node biopsy, say for a cutaneous lesion. So a lot of people will also have Merkel cell or melanoma more frequently, or even sort of aggressive squames. And so we do a case review that incorporates the sentinel lymph node biopsy experience, but we also wanted to make sure that we're equally sort of cognizant of potential variation in doing elective neck dissection. So as much as we sort of talk about it being sort of the mainstay of head and neck surgeons, you know, we've also seen papers out there where, you know, there's a magical kind of number where there seems to be a difference in sort of survival for our patients depending on nodal yield. And so that has all become part of the case review for our credentialing of surgeons. The second part of this then was to do the, so we incorporated a surgeon education course also. And so we had an initial course at the in January 2020 at the NRG oncology semi-annual meeting. And that was actually here in Houston. And so at that meeting, we had over 80 surgeons attend in person at NRG. And so that was very heartening to see, you know, one, that many surgeons come, but to see that there was real interest in this. But again, that was an opportunity to kind of talk about what are best practices, you know, and so we talked about surgical best practices. You know, people brought up sort of very valid questions. You know, there's a longstanding debate about, you know, do you do level 2B or not? Do you do level 4? And we talked about how that was incorporated into the trial. So we thought it was important for surgeon education as well as case review to sort of make sure we identify qualified surgeons. The third part of this, of course, is then the ongoing sort of quality assurance. So I have a panel of about 8 different surgeons experience in oral cavity sentinel lymph node biopsy. And so every case is then vetted. So sentinel lymph node or elective neck dissection. And we're not only just looking at the neck procedure, but we're also looking at the resection of the primary tumor. And we're trying to make sure that, you know, people are sort of falling into the guidelines as written in the protocol. And so, you know, in June, we also did another surgeon education course. Now we had to do it sort of via web, you know, and actually still we had over 60 surgeons attend that particular course. So we've had 140 some head and neck surgeons sort of attend. And so that's been good. And then we ended up creating video links for people who weren't able to attend. But I think you have to have multiple layers, sort of trying to bring everyone to at least an equivalent sort of cognitive level, right? The actual technical level, you sort of watch as they sort of do cases and accrue patients to the study. I give the advice quite often. I say, if you can, don't let your first patient necessarily be a patient, you know, on the study. That if you have to, and it's very reasonable to, it, you could do a sentinel lymph node biopsy, and I think Larissa said something earlier about this, but also do then the completion neck dissection. And that just sort of gives you a level of comfort that you're kind of doing it the right way, that your pathologist is finding what they need to find, that your nuclear medicine people are helping you as far as with the SPECT CT, and so that all of the components are running accurately before you sort of get into that first patient that's being randomized between the two treatment arms.
Yeah, I think that was an important part of my experience in gearing up to participate in the trial is just seeing that the, you know, all the pieces are in place and everything's working. So when you're talking to patients about the trial, how do you communicate regarding the randomization part of it? I mean, I think that's something that you know, as I'm looking to enroll my first patients in HN006, you know, that's a big question is how do you talk to them about the randomization?
You know, I think there's a couple of components to this. I think we have to do a better job getting patients onto clinical trials. We have to sort of help them to understand that while we're studying what we're doing, that what we're doing is sort of, it's not that we already know that one procedure is better than another, but it's that we really don't have that kind of highest level of evidence to sort of drive that decision. And that's why we're looking at it. Now we have hints and we have sort of, like I said, you have sort of retrospective data or experience from other institutions that you can look at, but we don't really have level one evidence. And while level one evidence is able to kind of explain to a patient, I think you have to always sort of maintain, we talk about equipoise all the time. And equipoise is easy in concept, but difficult in practice, right? You as a surgeon have to convey that you are okay or not just okay, but that you would be very comfortable having the patient either get, in this case, a sentinel lymph node biopsy or an elective neck dissection. And I actually think that that comes, there's a lot of practice to that particular art, right? Because your patient is looking at you for any clue, right? It's not just what you say, but it's the body language and things like that. They're looking for any clue to see that you're tipped one way or the other. And as soon as they get that sense, they're not going to go for a randomization. Now, randomization, you know, that's also one of those sorts of things that they say, oh, I'm not going to leave my life up to kind of the roll of dice or something like that. And I think that's where, again, it's sort of, that's the mechanism of the trial, but you're sort of looking at two potential sort of treatments that, again, you don't know that one is necessarily better than the other. And that's a message that, yeah, we are continuing to sort of, as we have discussions with patients, as I have discussions with surgeons, we're sort of getting a sense of what are the best practices as far as getting that across to our patients. And I actually think we probably have a lot to learn from our medical oncology and our radiation oncology colleagues on how to do that particular kind of counseling.
So I have a question from one of our young members about sentinel lymph node biopsy for early oral cancers in low resource settings. My practice is in Egypt, where the resources are limited. Do you think such a procedure is applicable in a limited resource environment?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair question. I think, you know, Dr. De Cruz, you know, in the paper they published in 2015, they said, hey, this is going to be one area of future exploration is whether or not there is less morbidity with sentinel lymph node biopsy, but without sort of any compromise to survival. You know, the actual practice of sentinel lymph node biopsy does require sort of additional resources. It requires imaging. It requires sort of more, it's a balance, right? Because you're not looking at 20, 25 lymph nodes. You're looking at sort of a handful, maybe two or three lymph nodes, but you are actually bisecting and going through many more sections of that particular lymph node. And then the actual radio trace, all of those are demanding in terms of resources. So it may not be at this time ideal for a more sort of moderate or low resource environment. But I think in practice, what we are trying to do is try to provide the best available care for our patients in the environment that they are currently in. And so when we talk about personalized therapy and we're talking about chemotherapy or targeted agents, that, you know, in terms of resources are so much more intensive, but that, you know, but rightfully so, can target genetic sort of vulnerabilities and those sorts of things. I think it's important that we sort of look at those and understand their effectiveness. But I think that as surgeons, we need to also continue to evolve our practice and our ability to sort of personalize medical care or surgical care for our patients, being cognizant that, yeah, that right now, this is probably not going to be a suitable sort of technique that can be sort of opened and accessible to sort of all resource environments.
And then as a last question here, what lessons would you want to impart on young members who are interested in participating, but also, you know, leading surgical trials in the future?
Get involved, you know, just get involved, go to a meetings, you know, read the papers. You know, I will tell you that, you know, however big these names are, there are people on the other side. When they can, they're more than willing to respond to your emails. I put my cell phone number up at every meeting now, and I put my email address up at every meeting now because I want people to get involved. This is my experience from HN006, but you know, I'm excited to meet more head and neck surgeons. I'm excited by people who actually are curious about the work and are curious and driven to sort of take better care of their patients and want to get involved in studies like this. But the only way to do a clinical study or clinical trial in the future is to actually participate in some of them at the ground level, right? Like you can theoretically draw all kinds of schema on PowerPoint, but to actually have boots on the ground and actually do a clinical trial and understand what it's like to get involved with your clinical trials office, to take a protocol through an IRB committee at your institution, I think you actually just have to get involved in a study. That's the biggest message I wanted to give was, you know, it's great to go to the meetings, but there's clearly an advantage to me, but I think there's an advantage to all of our young surgeons to get involved in these trials. This is the wave of the future. You know, level one evidence and sort of doing large scale prospective randomized trials is how we get to level one evidence. And we need to be at the table participating in those trials and then also subsequently developing those trials and being part of the solution. So that's kind of my message to young surgeons today.
Thanks very much, Dr. Lai. And thank you for chatting with us about this great topic and for all the great work you're doing.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This episode was produced by Chi-Chi Gao, a third-year medical student at the University of Kansas School of Medicine. She is an avid podcast listener and is thrilled to be behind the scenes in the creation of the Young Members Corner. Until next time, I'm your host, Andres Burr, and thank you for listening to the Young Members Corner.